Yo, what's going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me El Fauno!
El Fauno, that's right. I am Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Raymond.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
And joining us once again, we have the beautifully bearded Michael Burns.
Hey, friends, glad to be here.
And the beautifully shouldered today.
Yep, look at that.
It's too hot. It's just too hot, and fashion doesn't matter. And yes, if you're watching this, my disgusting hairy pale shoulders are showing. I apologize.
Is that a tie-dyed singlet there that you were rocking? Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Yin yang? Wow.
Well, it has the Greek or the Roman numerals for 6 and 9 inside of there as well. Because a yin yang is technically two things 69ing each other.
Look at layers of meaning.
I came to bring the intellect today, so let's go.
Looking forward to the philosopher reacts to your shirt.
All right, so this week we're going to be talking about the instant classic, written, directed, devised, inspired by the brilliant mind of Guillermo del Toro, Pan's Labyrinth, or in Spanish, it's El Laberinto del Fauno. It stars Ivana Baquero, Sergi Lopez, Maribel Verdú, Doug Jones, and Ariadne Gil. As always, we'll go around and we'll do first impressions. What was it like the first time we saw this film? How has this film lasted with us on repeated viewings? What's it like revisiting it? Let's start with the guest this week. Michael, what are your initial thoughts? What was it like the first time that you saw Pan's Labyrinth?
Well, so as anyone who has heard me on this podcast before, heard me talk about movies, knows, I have an aversion towards spooky and scary things. I'm not proud of it, but it is true, and I'm at least honest with it as an adult. Because of that, I have not really kept up with Guillermo del Toro's movies, and I had never seen this movie before. So I knew a lot about it, from participating in the cultural discourse, listening to too many podcasts, and reading stuff. Hadn't seen it, didn't know what to expect, watched it for the first time. Really enjoyed it overall, with the few instances where when there was what I described to Raymond before he went on as specific violence, I averted my eyes a few times in the film. Didn't love some of the brutality, just at a sort of visceral aesthetic level, but thought it was a really interesting movie. And what I did not think is that it was a movie that would make me think about, you know, the relationship between war and myth, and if it's possible to die a revolutionary death. And, you know, it made me think some stuff. So I really enjoyed it. Excited to talk about it. But positive vibes from me as I take a trip into Spooky Town.
Amazing. What about you, Raymond?
I was actually a little bit late to the party on this one. I remember when it came out and was, like you said, kind of an instant classic. It was something of a sensation straight out the gate. And even folks who didn't really know how to grab it, I think still understood that it was like, oh, this is pretty unique and refreshing and exciting. And certainly, despite having made some wonderful films up to this point, my favorite of his is Devil's Backbone, which is kind of like a sister film to this. This really feels like his arrival as an auteur. You know, this is the one that really put him on the map, at least globally, in a major way. The first time I saw it, I was actually living in New York and my roommate was, from Mexico, and I was watching the movie and she had talked it up. She loved it. And for whatever reason, my DVD just kind of sputtered out at one point and the subtitles just stopped working, for like the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes of the movie. And I paused it and had to wait for my roommate to get back home. And when she did, I said, hey, when you're all settled, I need you to do me a huge favor and just like narrate this movie for me in just the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Just live translate for you.
100%.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we sat down together and we watched the last 10 or 15 minutes of it. And she's keeping up with it and she's getting really enthusiastic because, like I said, she's a fan of the movie. And she goes, oh, okay, he's saying this and this is kind of how to interpret it. And this is what it means. And the specificity of the language is such that blah, blah, blah. And then we get to the end of it and she's so amped up and she goes, well, now I really want to watch this. And so we just restarted it and played it again. And it was one of those movies that even like sitting there in a dorm room, watching it on a laptop with, you know, the subtitles fritzing out on me. Like I said before, I could still tell it was something really, really special. And ever since, I mean, Guillermo del Toro is one of my icons, one of my heroes. I think he's one of the folks that I most revere in the cinematic arts. And I think what I respond to most with his movies is this constant sense of curiosity and discovery. And he paints with such a broad and expansive palette. His movies may not always be great, or they may be a little bit weird or a little unwieldy, but they're always unique. There's always something special about them. So I'm really excited to talk about this one tonight.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the camp that I really didn't understand it when I first saw it. Like, I didn't quite get it. Like, you know, at one level I got it, but I didn't really understand the depth, the use of, you know, a particular genre known as magical realism that emerged in like the middle of the 20th century in Latin America with like Borges and Gabriel Garcia Marquez and some others. And I didn't really understand the genre too much. So I saw it and I thought it was going to be like a fairy tale. And I was like, oh, this is scary. That's like a scary monster. Like, I thought it was going to be kind of fluffy, like Disney-like, because I was told that it was a fairy tale. And so I didn't really kind of get the aesthetic, because I'd never seen anything of his prior to this film. So I didn't really understand what he was doing. So it kind of took me, I think, repeated viewings to really kind of fully grasp the magic and the depth and the sort of wonder and beauty that the film presents, but also what it stimulates and evokes in my own sort of musings and imaginations as I participate in the imagery and whatnot as it's played out in front of me. And so the first time I saw it, I was definitely kind of like, oh, this is cool, but I just kind of don't know if I fully get it. And then on repeated viewings, I actually think it's one of the best films that's ever been made. It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think the themes that it addresses are perfectly in my wheelhouse about the real versus the imaginary, and how we're always constructing imaginary frameworks, and that the adult world of war, imperialism, exploitation, gender inequality, hierarchy, that's also a form of imaginative construction, and that the quote imaginary world that is played out at least in this film in the eyes of youthful innocence and childlike wonder is no less real, and that it might even be more powerful because it recognizes certain elements of creativity and beauty that the adult imaginary doesn't, at least how it's played out here. So for me, I think that there's just so much to explore at a political level. Obviously, the film is intentionally anti-fascist, as it is exploring Franco's Spain in 1944, you know, a handful of years after the end of the Civil War in Spain. And you obviously have rebels in the hills that are kind of Republican, communist, rebels that are anti-fascist, intentionally so, and they're being suppressed by this dominant dictatorial representative in the form of Ophelia's stepfather, the captain. So I think that there's a lot politically there. Philosophically, I think it's interesting. And then I think we could even say at like a psychological level, there's something really interesting about this young girl who's dealing with the loss of her father. So there's an exploration of trauma and how you deal with grief and sadness and things like that. So I think it's really fantastic at pretty much every level. And I do think it's probably, I mean, it'd be one of my favorite films ever. In my top whatever 50 20 30 somewhere in that range, you know, don't know if it'd be like a top 10 for me, but definitely I think if push came to shove, in the top 20 top 30 range for sure. So I'm excited to talk about it. All right, I do want to let people know we are live right now, so if you're in the chat, please make sure you contribute questions, thoughts, things like that. We are keeping an eye on what's going on in the YouTube chat, so give us your contributions, what you think about this film and even Del Toro's filmography, other things that he's done. We have a Twitter account. Make sure you follow that. Show Me the Meaning. It's SMTM_POD. So give us a follow there. We're, you know, tweeting out extras and thoughts and threads, and Raymond's always got cool shit that he's sharing in relation to films that we discuss here that is being retweeted by that account there. So go give us a follow, SMTM_POD. Before we start peeling this thing apart, I got to give a little rundown here of what this film is about for people that aren't familiar with the film, or if you are familiar with the film, here's just a quick little recap. All right, so basically, The film opens on a dying young girl who we come to learn is Ophelia. A voiceover tells us of a magical kingdom where a princess once reigned. And after she died, it was promised that her soul would return once again. So her father built these labyrinths everywhere so that she could find her way back to her underground kingdom. We then get thrown into the middle of Franco's fascist reign in Spain in 1944. Now, young Ophelia is headed to her new home with her pregnant and sick mother so they can move in with Ophelia's new stepfather, the captain of a fascist outpost who's working to eradicate resistance armies. One night, Ophelia is led by a fairy to a labyrinth where they descend into the earth and meet the Faun. The Faun explains that she is the reincarnated Princess Moana and that she must fulfill three tasks in order to acquire her kingdom. Now, she completes the first task with ease by retrieving a key from the belly of a toad, and after this, the Faun gives a mandrake root to Ophelia to place under her sick mother's bed to heal her. Immediately, and basically miraculously, her mother begins to feel better. Now, for the second task, Ophelia is charged with getting the dagger in an underground lair, but she's warned not to consume any of the tasty food that is down there. But of course, she succumbs and she eats a grape, waking the pale man, who ends up eating two of the fairies. And after this, of course, the Faun is super pissed and he curses Ophelia and he tells her that she can never return to the underground world. Now, meanwhile, while all this is going on in the captain's house, there's some spies that have infiltrated the captain's ranks, and his suspicions start to rise, leading him to snuff out the traitors in his household. He kills a doctor and then captures Mercedes, who is a housekeeper. But before he can torture her for information, she stabs him multiple times, cuts his face up Joker style, and runs out of the house. The Faun changes his mind, and he decides that he's going to give Ophelia one more chance. And he says that she must bring her newborn brother to the labyrinth. So Ophelia drugs the captain, grabs the baby, and then when she reaches the labyrinth, the Faun explains that they must spill the baby's blood. But Ophelia refuses, and she chooses to protect the baby instead. Now, just at this point, the captain appears, grabs the baby, and shoots Ophelia. Then moments later, the captain is stopped by rebels who shoot and kill him without letting him give a message that he wants to his son, saying that, no, your son will never know anything about you. The film then closes with Ophelia's blood dripping into the labyrinth, where she is then transported to a celestial type of kingdom, where it's explained that she passed the final test and sacrificed herself rather than her brother, so she's invited to sit on the throne next to her father and mother. And an epilogue tells us that she ruled wisely for many centuries and left quiet traces of herself in the human realm that are visible only to those who know where to look. End of movie. All right, before we continue, we got to give a quick shout out to our sponsor at Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over 1 million plus royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. Look, don't get stuck in your project because you can't find the right footage or sound effect or background music. I've been there many times. You get frustrated, then you got to try to figure out some sort of way to rip something, and then it might not be legal, and then you're risking yourself, and then even then it's not good quality, or you have to pay for it or something like that. Don't deal with any of that madness. Head over to Storyblocks, which is a badass content library, and you can get all your friggin' royalty-free goodies. So storyblocks.com/wisecrack, or you can click the link down in the description so that you can learn more about Storyblocks. Again, that's storyblocks.com/wisecrack, or click the link down below so you can learn all about the risk-free quality goodies that you can get from Storyblocks. They're badass. I use them. Wisecrack use them. You just go. There's no reason not to. Storyblocks.com/wisecrack. Click the link down in the show notes. Now back to the show. All right. So this film has been sort of notably placed in this genre that is called magical realism. Now, some people like the term. Some people think the term is actually a useless term because it can be too broad, because once you start thinking about the imagination, then isn't everything magical realism? Isn't all cinema, all storytelling, isn't everything, even documentary, isn't that magical realism? But the point with magical realism is that it's intentionally trying to bring the fantastical or the supernatural or the mythical into the quote-unquote real world, rather than a film like Lord of the Rings, which is takes place in a sort of fantasy world. Fantasy is sort of infused into the quote-unquote real world. So that's what this film is kind of, that, or that's where this film is oftentimes placed. So I think one of the interesting things we can talk about here is, what is magical about this film, And what do we think the film does by blurring those lines between the quote-unquote magical, fantastical, and the quote-unquote real? And then what can we do with that? Like, why is that amazing? And then, of course, more importantly, how does Del Toro do it, right? And like, as a filmmaker, let's talk about that execution a little bit. Raymond, you got some initial thoughts on this?
Oh, sure. Why not? I think, this is a lot to snap off right at the beginning. But you kind of alluded to something I think pretty instructive in your opening thoughts on this, Austin, that Del Toro has stated pretty explicitly, like on the commentary for this movie, he says he doesn't believe in government, he doesn't believe in borders. And this is a movie, like you said, that sort of interrogates that tension between the accepted fantasy of, you know, once again, what he says in the commentary is like politics, religion, money, you know, class, etc. All of these things are, you know, validated as adult concerns, but fantasy is stigmatized, or it's relegated to childhood, or looked down upon, or, you know, however you want to describe it. And there is this beautiful, not just lack of judgment, but real embracing of the fantastic across all of his movies. He did this wonderful interview with, I think her name is Carolyn Frumke. She's a fantasy author. I believe she did Inkheart. I'm not familiar with her work, but they referenced a few of her books in the interview that the two of them were doing together. And he said, you know, 100 years from now, people will look back and say, wow, they were crazy, all this stuff that they were doing, and what, you know, why would that make any sense to them? But fantasy will still be timeless, you know. It'll be just as timeless as it is now, despite being 100 years old. It'll still be timeless 100 years hence. And there is a sort of strain of that in this film that I know there are a lot of folks who watch this and fret over the ambiguity of it all. You know, is it all in her head? Are these two parallel realities that Ophelia is just able to kind of move between? And I think that kind of misses the point, that to Ophelia, it is real. It may just be subjective, but it is real. And all of the events of the film, both in reality and in fantasy, both inform and sort of instruct her in a certain way and help her develop and grow as a person. So what can really be more real than that, you know? And I think that that's kind of the secret to it, is just he engages this world at her level, and despite what everyone is telling her, he makes a point of always having her make her decisions, make those decisions for herself, even if it means disobeying the authority figures. She's always sticking by her gut and engaging the world on her terms. And I think that is, to answer your question, I think that's really really a key part of why the fantasy aspects of this work so well, especially when the lines start to blur.
Yeah, I think like one way I definitely read it a little bit was like this idea that there's no room for magic and fascism, and that like because the, you know, non-labyrinth world is so coldly fascistic, it's almost like they pushed out the realm of dreams and fantasy and magic, and it had to find home underground. So there's this like uneven surplus of imagination and magic on one side, because the political reality of that world has no room for that, no space for imagination or wonder or magic or anything like that. And, you know, it made me think a little bit too about like how the way children are treated in the film. Obviously we have Ophelia, but even like the way in which her unborn brother is kind of treated off the rip is more as a prop for the captain than anything else, which then, you know, kind of did make me think of how, whether it's Socrates or Christ, this emphasis that like children are the ones who are always ready to hear the more radical message. Children are the ones who have that sense of wonder. And well, then no pun intended, but no wonder that Ophelia has to like go to this magical world to find that, because the upstairs non-labyrinthian world is just so devoid of all of those things. And I don't know. That was my initial thought, and kind of building off what you were saying, Raymond, which I also agreed with.
Yeah, there's something. I mean, it seems pretty clear too that it's underground, so it's hidden. Is it repressed? You know, is it like my acting coach shouts to Anthony Mindel. He always says, "What what you resist persists, right? Which is also something they talk about in like transcendental meditation and stuff like that. Or you could say it in fancier terms, you could be like, you know, there's a return of the repressed. And so it's this idea that, yeah, you can hide all the magic that you want. You can suppress it, you can deny it, but eventually it's going to come back. Like, you can't ultimately get rid of whatever it is that's being hidden. Is it the world of possibility? Is it the world of potential? Is it the world that exists outside of what you deem to be real? And one thing we can say that this sort of fascist regime, it tries to monopolize that which is real. This is good, this is bad, this is right, this is the way to do it. Those other things are not the way to do it. Those other things are the wrong way. Those other things are outside of the bounds of what we deem to be right. And if you have control over the terms of what is real, then you can control a lot of things. But I think what Del Toro does is he kind of says, ah, but even those people who are controlling what is real, they're actually engaged in a type of fabrication. They're still constructing. They're still imagining a world. They just do it in a suppressive way, right? And so then what you get is this blurring of the lines between one form of imagining, which is supposedly real, which is used to wield power in an oppressive and exploitative sense, and this other form of imagination that is one that is bountiful, that is, I mean, there's this idea that the mandrake root, you know, the reason that it's a mandrake root is they are related to fertility. So again, there's bounty. You know, the Spanish title isn't Pan's Labyrinth, but it's the Labyrinth of the Faun, right? And who's the character of the Faun? And he talks about, the Faun even talks about how I'm like of the earth and I'm ancient. And so there's something also that's maybe ecological here. There's something about the natural world. And I love, love, love the allusions to Alice in Wonderland, but the color of Ophelia's dress is green, right? And she's going into this cave to defeat this toad who's rotting a tree, right? So there's all these like environmental and maybe what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of like cohesive ways of relating with the world rather than through suppression, oppression, exploitation, hierarchy, patriarchy, dominance, you know, stratification that you get in the militaristic world.
And you mentioned the mandrake root specifically, but this film is replete with yonic imagery throughout. There's a very explicit line drawn between you know, maternalism and nature and the sort of like nurturing aspects of nature. You know, when she's crawling through the tunnel in which she meets the toad, it's Del Toro describes that as like the uterine wall, and he talks about the pale man's banquet in much the same terms. And speaking of the divide between reality and fantasy within this, they do a wonderful job aesthetically of coding the two worlds as well. That, you know, reality is all in these really cold grays and blues and greens, as you mentioned, and then as they start to introduce the fantastic, you see these much warmer colors start to intrude on the real world. And the first glimpse of that you get, fittingly enough, for the sort of maternal motif throughout, is when she is laying her ear against her mother's womb and you know, singing to her brother. And you see this beautiful amber glow and all of these sort of like root-like appendages that are kind of growing off of him, and it's all that stuff is made pretty visually explicit, and it's one of those things that once again helps introduce those fantastic themes and ease them into the real world, because without even really noticing it, he starts to use warmer hues on the characters above ground, and that just kind of like subconsciously primes you for when those worlds finally collide near the end. It really is a beautiful piece of artistry, and hats off to Guillermo Navarro, the director of photography as well. Sorry, Michael, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, how cool is it that the way that eventually Ophelia commutes between the worlds is a piece of chalk?
Yeah.
This idea that something so simple is all that it takes to create that transformation, to get to that world or let some of it in. I really dug that.
And something so elementary, yeah. Like I don't necessarily know that this was intentional, but you know, the clear association with chalk for me is not just school, but very early childhood education, you know, before whiteboards and overheads and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, what do we think? There's something, so Misty in the chat said that they always say that fans of Miyazaki should watch Pan's Labyrinth. When you were talking earlier, I was thinking of Miyazaki too, because a lot of Miyazaki's themes are exploring children versus adults, right? Ecology, peace, nature versus sort of the industrialization and technologization of the land and of our own human, quote-unquote, natures, right? So there's something that's being exploited here. What do we think about, and philosophers love to talk about this too. One of my favorite philosophers, a French philosopher named Alain Badiou, you know, talks a lot about youth as being like...
I was going to bring him up later. I had this note. It was going to be all smart. And now you did. So when I do it, people will be like, wow, Michael comes on and just like fucking copies whatever Austin says. It's pathetic. Sorry, keep going.
I mean, to be fair, we did study at the same place and with some same influences. So, you know, it's...
I'm totally whatever. Out of my depth with it. The two of you. All I do is watch movies.
No, hey, fuck. I love it. I love it. But it's this idea of romanticizing, maybe to the point of fetishizing, but romanticizing youth as an agent of revolutionary change. And there's something about that. And what do we think here? What is this film exploring about the innocence of childhood? Is there something just inherently good about childhood? And then is there something inherently bad about getting old and getting stodgy and getting cranky? Like, is it that, because that seems to be something that's explored, whether or not it is drawing the lines as hard as I'm drawing them now. What do we think about this tension?
Well, I'm curious what you guys think about the captain's watch, right? Because that's his connection to childhood and his father and his death. I imagine it's trying to say something about these things, but how do you guys read that?
I thought of it as control over time, like the most fundamental thing. Like,
so the reason he keeps trying to turn it back on, even though it's dead, his dad's time has stopped, but he keeps fidgeting, keeps trying to have control over it.
And I think that the clock is one of the fundamental things that has shifted us into the quote unquote modern world. It's about a control over time, about a control over space, right? And if you can control time, you can control how your troops are being deployed, you can control how supplies are being delivered, you can control the production of goods and services, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can create and construct a way of measuring reality, and you do that through the quantification of nature in the form of time, if you can do that, then you have great immense power. And so I think that for me is that's like his fundamental form of control, which is why it's also the last thing that he looks at. And then he says, you know, tell my son da 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 da. And Mercedes, and I love that it's a woman that stands up too, because there's also clearly like this kind of like patriarchal gender domination that is being explored too. And she says, nah, fuck you, bro. She's not gonna know he's not gonna know anything about you.
That line rules so hard.
You bring up the watch, and I think that is a lovely bit of business that he's consumed with throughout. But if most of the stuff where we see him, at least when the character is being introduced, he's deeply concerned with the not only the minutiae of something like the watch, but also he's peering through that little sort of jeweler's loop at a map. And if you look at the set surrounding him when he's fixing the watch, the first time you see him fiddling with it, he's surrounded by all these giant cogs, as though he himself is like part of this machine, and that he's so consumed by the gears of all of it that he misses the forest for the trees in a way. And I do think it's very telling that when he's confronted about it at dinner, that he says, no, my father never had a watch. And it's one of those things that's like, okay, what does that say about the character? Is he, he's so consumed or obsessed by this object and the fact that he has to deny its very existence? Is it because he can't control it, because he can't coax his whim out of it in much the same way he's able to control everyone else around him? It's a really smart bit of writing. I like this movie, guys.
I'm starting to realize that. I think Raven likes it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely something about psychic repression here, right? Like he can't be vulnerable. He can't explore his own daddy issues, right? Even though it's interesting, the film kind of takes place in the context of a young girl who lost her father in the war. And I wonder, was her father a rebel? Like, we don't really get much information. What side of the war was he on? But we just know that
he was on the bad side, because he tailored the uniforms for the bad guys.
Okay, I missed that part. Yeah. Okay.
That's how the mother met the captain.
There's also, you bring up Mercedes' line to the captain about, you know, he won't even know your name. And that is, Del Toro, I was reading, I think it was the companion book to At Home with Monsters, his museum exhibit. And he was talking in that book. There's a wonderful interview with him where he talks about how death is really not necessarily the end of life so much as, you know, a natural part of life. It's what gives life meaning. And immortality is not about living forever. It's about living meaningfully and living through the words and deeds of the ones you leave behind, the ones that you love. And for her to twist the knife, like knowing that that's how Del Toro feels about life and death, for Mercedes to say at the end, like, your own son, the seed that bears your name won't even know who it's from if he continues to carry your name at that. It's just one of those things that, like, knowing Del Toro's thought process on all of this, it becomes so much more of a fuck you, because it's like, oh, that is that it, not only is the captain dying, he is ceasing to exist by having no legacy. And for someone as vain as he is, that is a fate worse than death.
Yeah, well, so Del Toro quotes Kierkegaard, a Soren Kierkegaard, Danish philosopher, when describing this. I found this quote earlier, and of course I got all giddy when I heard he talked about Kierkegaard in relation to the movie. But Del Toro said, "I always think of that beautiful quote by Kierkegaard that says, the tyrant's reign ends with his death, but the martyr's reign starts with his death. I think that is the essence of the movie. It's about living forever by choosing how you die." And I do think, like, that's why the final scene and the pile of death is so important, because I think we see that contrast. What does the tyrant's death look like? We see it in the captain. What does the martyr's death look like? And maybe we see a version of that in Ophelia.
You certainly see the martyr in the doctor who
definitely
the rebel out of his misery. And on the fittingly enough, on the commentary, Del Toro says that the last, you know, 15 or 20 paces that doctor takes before being shot, he told the actor, this is the pinnacle, this is the highest moment of your life, and this is the greatest thing you've ever done, and you're gonna die knowing that.
Yeah, and this connects back to something Austin said earlier. Oh, go ahead, Austin.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
No, and this just reminds me of the French guy you brought up earlier, who likes that idea of, like, of becoming immortal, which just means, like, living for an idea or a cause that transcends your mortality, so that, in a sense, you can be a martyr, you can live forever, you participate in something that's so great that even after you're gone, there's still the effects of that are happening. You're still connecting to that idea.
So these effects, let's say they're there, but they're not at the surface, right? And the whole epilogue where it says they're visible only to those who know where to look. Mm-hmm. So is that the idea that Ophelia, that her martyrdom, the imprint that she left on the world is there? And it's kind of, because it's a fairy tale, so we could kind of imagine you telling this to a child and then inspiring your child to look for the marks of Ophelia, right? So it's almost like, I just got chills. I don't know if you guys find this. I literally just got chills thinking about this.
But it's like,
and you see this. I did. I gave myself goosebumps. But it's like this beautiful flower is blooming on the tree where she left her dress when she went in.
Love
it. And so the idea is that there are these fingerprints there, but you have to know how to look. And you have to know where to look. But what that does is it sort of challenges you, inspires you, and maybe even empowers you to continue to live in the wake of the event that was Ophelia,
yeah.
Right? And there's something lovely about that. I'm just getting head nods. I feel like I'm in church right now.
No, yeah. I think,
amen.
I think
amen,
you also
brother.
Just like name.
Do you want me to tag?
No,
that?
For sure.
I agree.
Yeah. No, I too agree, Austin. Good job.
I think it's one of those tough things that all three of us are going around and we're just like, you know what I love about this movie? You know what I love about it? And I'm not going to say, no, Austin, you don't love that about that movie.
Right.
I mean, if we need someone to be negative, I can be a little bit negative.
Yeah, do
that
it.
Fuels the conversation on. I guess for me, I don't know. I think there's something about, okay, I'll devil's advocate myself. I understand a certain necessity of the brutality in the film for getting at the gnarliness and the absolute lack of concern for life by the fascist. Obviously, I think for me, the scene that hit me the hardest as someone that doesn't like super gnarly violent stuff is the father and son
the wine bottle
hunting for rabbits.
Yeah,
and that was, like, really brutal. There is a part of me that a little bit is like, and this is one of the reasons I avoid spooky stuff sometimes, because I feel like it's used for effect, but without much residual meaning. Now, in this film, I felt a good amount of impact from those scenes, but I wonder, like, I don't know. I wonder for y'all who know more about Del Toro, and maybe there's one person listening to this podcast that's also as naive as I am about those films, and one other person who hates spooky stuff. I love you. I'm here for you. I don't know. You say a little bit more. Like, why do we need that?
I think, you know, when you read about the Spanish Civil War, there's something insane. Like, half of the casualties were summarily executed, or just like murdered in cold blood. They weren't like combatants, or you know, or if they were combatants, they were executed long after they had left the field of battle. And I think it was likely pretty important for him to demonstrate that brutality up front, to recognize that, like, not only is this person evil, he's inhuman, he can't be reasoned with, there's nothing that you can appeal to. You know, he has sacrificed his humanity. And I also think,
yeah, he calls himself some type of monster in the film. Like, he refers to himself as a monster.
And of course, over the course of the film, he slowly transforms into one. He is, you know, little by little, he's deformed by the injuries and the wounds that that are inflicted upon him. But I also think that, giving the movie not only that sense of heightened stakes with his presence, but also demonstrating that this movie as a piece of art has the capacity for that degree of extreme violence. I think I'm not saying this in a reductive way, but in just sort of a literalized way, it's a way of pulling older audiences down to its level to say that, like, you're not above fantasy. Like, I want you to see the world through a child's eyes, as fantastic and as frightening as that may seem. In equal parts, take the good with the bad. Those are my thoughts.
The only hard part I have with some of that then is, yeah, and I want to hear Austin's, and I just wonder this too, how it relates. One thing I had a little bit of a slight problem with was the mom, because I'm like, wow, you seem great. Ophelia loves you a lot. Why did you get impregnated and marry this horrible guy? And then, of course, I thought maybe that's like a protective mechanism. I don't know what the world was like for her when her husband died. But there was a part of me in the movie that got mad at Ophelia's mom for putting her in that situation to begin with, which took me out of it momentarily.
Yeah, interesting. So there's so much here that I thought was fascinating. You were talking about how the captain is referred to as a monster. He sort of transforms into a monster. And then the
He gets Joker-fied.
And then the sort of brutality of, let's just take that one scene where he uses the wine bottle to smash the young man's face. I like the fact that the quote unquote real world has humans who are more monstrous than the monsters of the underworld. Although the Pale Man is pretty fucking scary, but the Fawn, just from his appearance, is terrifying. And you're like, oh my god, but yet Ophelia is not afraid of the Fawn. And these fairies are pretty creepy looking. They're not like Tinkerbell, right? It's like they're kind of a little scary. They kind of look like orc-like. They're kind of demon-looking-y, and they're kind of creepy, right? Yeah. So this underground world...
This wasn't like Julia Roberts in Hook.
No, it was not.
Although I heard she was much more difficult to work with than the fairies in this.
True.
What you get then in the real world is the world of monsters, like real monsters, bad monsters, the monsters of imperialism, the monsters of fascism, the monsters of oppression, things like that. And I think one of the things that's interesting is, well, where do these stories come from? These stories come from the fears of what is potentially in humanity that are then monsterized in the form of vampires and werewolves and ghosts and goblins and ghouls and things like that. Because it's actually us. And this goes back to what we talked about with Apocalypse Now, like horror has a human face. It's really like the worst of what is possible within humanity that we deem to be the monstrous, right? But it doesn't mean that you have to look like a monster to be monstrous. You can look like a monster and actually be the hero, right? Like Hellboy is a great example of this, right? It looks like a monster, but it's kind of a hero. Well, with this, you can look like a nice-looking, put-together, strapping, you're serving your country, and you're a fucking monster. And I think that's important because then the quote-unquote real world is still then the world of monsters and fantasy and grotesque violence. So when he smashes that young guy's face with the wine bottle, it needs that level of brutality in the service of the story to make the real world fantastical. Because no one's face actually caves like that with a wine bottle, right? You can't scrush a person's...
How do you know that? I don't like that you know that so
Del Toro actually said that was based on Well, Del Toro said that was actually based on something he witnessed firsthand, that he got into, not necessarily a bar fight, but he and a friend were jumped, and some guys were hitting Guillermo del Toro with a chain, and their friends were hitting Del Toro's friend with a wine bottle, or a beer bottle, I think it was, and the beer bottle just didn't break, and they kept just jamming it and jamming and just hitting him and hitting him, and he was like, I'm getting my ass beaten with this chain, and all I could think about is like, you know, it always breaks in like westerns and stuff. Like, it's just,
yeah, the
it's
sugar just glass
so, yeah, exactly. It is one of those things that like that made a really distinct impression on him. But you talk about the relative sense of monstrosity, the poles that exist within this film, where very scary movie monsters are sort of portrayed neutrally. You know, maybe the Pale Man is a little bit more malevolent, but he still has some rules, you know. Whereas, once again, to reiterate, like you were saying, the folks above ground, not so much. They can't be reasoned with. And he did this interview a while back where he was talking about how the reason he has such a passion and affinity for monsters, this is something you can't talk about Del Toro without talking about monsters, is that when he looks in a magazine or he looks on a billboard or he watches TV, he doesn't see himself. And he said something about how, I'm paraphrasing, but something about how models and magazines are so far on this side of the spectrum that if you put Frankenstein's monster on the other side, he's like, no, I look way, way closer to this side of the spectrum. And that just, he's like, you know, it is part of his sort of identity, his empathy with these creatures, that, you know, that they are us, that the real monstrosity in his mind is the sort of canonized sense of beauty that everyone is expected to maintain, even though it may be unattainable.
Yeah, he gave a really good speech to that effect. I think it was after one of the awards that Shape of Water got, whatever year that was that the Oscars happened. But yeah, I found it very compelling at the time, even though I hadn't watched much.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, and then kind of picking up on your point, Michael, about being a little bit frustrated about why the mother would put Ophelia into this situation in the first place. I mean, the chat's going off right now with some good contributions. Donna said, you know, it's a time frame where women didn't have many choices, especially when such an opportunity is presented to her. Shelter and the possibility of her daughter living a better life. There's something interesting. One of the soldiers at one point, when he's touting like the benefits of Franco's regime, it's fire and bread. Every household that is united under this regime is going to have fire and bread. So it's like the basic elemental components of life. It's like if you just embrace this nationalistic, united regime, then you will have warmth. Fire, which is also like the foundation of technology, right? So there's maybe a nod to Prometheus here and this idea of humanity being bestowed with the gifts of being able to have control over nature, right? Which is also why you have the captain with the clock and standing in that workshop, you know, constantly fiddling with things and like the gear.
And Prometheus, of course, imagery. His eyes were pecked out, you know.
So there's something interesting maybe there. And then bread, which is food for survival, right? So there's something about creating this world that will have mastery and that will protect you. And in this world, in order to be fed and to kind of participate in the kind of like modernization of society, maybe she didn't really have many choices. So she had to kind of
yeah,
fit within
definitely.
That. And so that seems like maybe the obvious way of thinking about it. But then at the same time, you still think like, what the fuck? Like, I know it is kind of shitty. It is kind of, you feel like it's kind of shitty. And it's, so it's like, there's an empathy that's like, okay, so we understand, but at the same time, does that justify it? I don't know. It's one of those sticky situations.
There's also kind of a subtle implication that, the captain may have been responsible for her husband's death, or that he kind of had his eye on her before, her husband was disappeared. So
do you think then he was responsible for the death and then he like forces her to
I
come?
I think there's kind of an implication that...
Because that's the most monstrous shit one can do.
Yeah.
I think there's sort of an implication that she not only... Like, she didn't meet this guy in a park and just find out about the fascist stuff later.
Oh, he wasn't playing the violin in a park?
And I think you bring up something...
But he was so nice to her at that dinner.
You bring up something interesting about I hadn't really thought of the Prometheus connection with the Pale Man until you mentioned that, Austin, but also the bread that when they're talking about that has the sort of the screed on the back, the polemic written on it, you know, that was a real thing. Like that, loaves of bread were dropped all over Spain with fascist propaganda written on the back of them. You know, and that's something that, like you said, within that one scene, you can see how persuasive that could be.
Can we just nerd out for a little bit now about the practical effects?
We haven't been nerding out already.
Yeah. About the filmmaking craft. You know, we've been talking a lot about the themes and the storytelling devices, but let's just talk about the fucking monsters.
Yeah, all praises and the cinematography and the colors. To David Martí and her name is Mansi Ribe. They're the two effects artists, the makeup artists who were awarded Oscars for their efforts in this. Just a match made in heaven. They've done, I think, most of Del Toro's work. And now, of course, after the Oscar win, they've worked on tons of stuff. Doug Jones as well, an often overlooked actor who, you know, spends as much time underneath makeup as he does with his normal face. You know, that this really is like, it's so cool to watch all the behind the scenes features on this movie and see the sort of like Justice League of practical effects coming together to make something really, really special. You know, this was, I think, in some of his movies, the CGI cat is kind of out of the bag a little bit, and maybe Crimson Peak, which is one of my favorite of his, it gets a little bit awash, even though they used practical effects and then did CGI augmentation over it. Sometimes it feels a little bit too heavy, but this one is just a wonderful blend where they're using the CGI to extract Doug Jones's real legs and just leave the puppet legs behind. And I mean, there's so many incredible design anecdotes that they reveal in the behind the scenes stuff. I could talk about this all day, man.
Well, let's keep talking about it then, brother.
I didn't want to hog the mic. I thought you guys might have some thoughts.
Go. This is good shit.
It looks very good. I enjoyed watching it because of how it looked good, and I appreciate the work done by those folks.
I think the thing that I want to draw attention to are a couple of ways of that this film really comes to life for me. Like, one, the color palette, I think, really serves the fairy tale vibe. Like, it just looks, as soon as the film starts, it looks magical. The greens, it's almost a little oversaturated, and so it kind of just creates this mood and this tone as soon as the film starts, right? And then there are these really clever editing devices, like the use of cuts by like panning across a tree that then sort of cuts between
all those vertical wipes that kind of give the suggestion of flipping a page in a storybook,
which is amazing. And then it's the integration of practical and special effects, of CG effects with practical, that I think is wonderful. So often we see films that over rely on CG, and they don't do the monster makeup and the silicone like a Carpenter film or something like that. But I am a huge fan and advocate and supporter of the use of practical effects. I just think there's something truly wonderful about seeing a human in a rubber suit. And then on top of that, then what you have then are the ways that all of these things are brought together with like a really lovely, simple soundtrack, I think, that almost kind of plays in the background. I mean, there's that really...
built around that lullaby.
Yeah, that lullaby, that humming. It's fucking fantastic. It just kind of sets this tone, and I really feel like it's an adult fairy tale in so many ways, but it's in the format of a child's fairy tale, but it's scary as fuck, so clearly it's not for children.
And before we move on, just to double back and do a little more Doug Jones praise, I don't think folks realize Doug Jones, not only a wonderful actor, a wonderful mime, also one of the nicest people in Hollywood history. He's like the sweetest person ever. And in this movie, not only is he bringing his phenomenal physical performances to life, he is not a Spanish speaker. He learned all of these lines phonetically. They were dubbed over afterwards, but Del Toro had told him, you know, you can just move your mouth, or you can count or something, and then we'll dub over and match it to your mouth movements and cut away when it doesn't match. And he was like, what the hell kind of world is that for this little girl that I'm going to be acting with? So for
That's
months,
so great.
Yeah, for months in advance of going to shoot this, he drilled all of his lines, getting them down. And he said it was still pretty rusty on the day, and he had to go through pretty slowly. But to not only be giving this unbelievable extraterrestrial physical performance, but also to be doing it in a language that you don't speak, to have to learn that phonetically, and also be doing all of that while only being able to see the world through two little tear ducts on the fawn's face, or two little nostrils on the pale man's face. I mean, it is a top-tier performance. I don't think these kind of actors, Toby Kebbell has appeared on screen a lot more frequently, but the Andy Serkises of the world, Toby Kebbell did wonderful work in the Planet of the Apes updates. And folks just don't give them the credit they're due, because this is an extremely challenging kind of performance, and there aren't a lot of folks out there who could pull it off.
Yeah, one of the things I think that's interesting, and this is kind of the last thing I'll say.
One more, sorry, Javier Botet.
Yeah.
Javier Botet, who's like the Spanish Doug Jones. He's amazing. He did like the Crooked Man in the Conjuring movies. But sorry, go ahead.
No, I think the last thing I'll say about this film, from my perspective, is that this film, it tells story and it uses certain technological devices in telling story in a way that is so unique, because it kind of is just literally creating a world and creating a narrative and creating a way of communicating morals without one condescending to like what people want to hear. You know, or without kind of condescending to the way that we use storytelling devices. Like, there's something, I don't know if it's just because I'm like seduced by the film, but it feels very unique and original in how it just tells story by kind of just creating a fucking fantasy and creating a way of telling a moral tale. And it's using historical experience and things like that. But I don't know. There's something so clever and unique about it that it makes sense then that the makeup is going to be unique, that the performances are going to have a unique flair to them. Like, when you create a space like that as a filmmaker or as someone who's creating a collaborative environment, everyone kind of buys into it and they can kind of like contribute something. And I think that's just like a really wonderful way to be a manager. And a director really is a fucking manager of an artistic project. And I think that's fucking amazing.
Yeah, he has a wonderful control over each and every one of his visions. He describes his crew as being a table, that there are four legs. It's the director, the cinematographer, the art department, and the wardrobe department. And if the four of them are not doing the same job and not working together, then it all falls apart. And he, you know, it comes as no surprise that he would have such a clear visual metaphor for what he does.
All right, final thoughts, Michael, before we jump into the mailbag here?
Really good movie. Glad I watched it. Glad I got bullied into it. And I think anything that makes you that remains a fairy tale while talking about the wonder that's still possible in our deaths and mortalities, I find really interesting and really important stuff. And anything that deals with learning how to die and thinking about the meaning of death, I'm all in on that. So,
does it make you want to watch more of his work now that you've kind of cracked the top of it?
You know what, I'll be honest, still probably
still
no on some of the stuff. You will not find me watching The Shape of Water anytime soon. Maybe what's the one you had mentioned the title before that he says is like the
Devil's
spiritual
Backbone.
Cousin to this one? So I will start there. I'll say this has made me want to watch Devil's Backbone. I will see where the
that's
spirit
a great one. That's
there.
Kind of like the ghost story to this one's fairy tale. And cool. it also takes place 5 years before this movie and was made exactly 5 years before this movie. Like he deliberately spaced them out, and there are actually two characters from Devil's Backbone that are found dead in the forest in Pan's Labyrinth, for keen-eyed viewers.
Apparently there's supposed to be a third, right? There's like a kind of spiritual trilogy that he's been promising: Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, and then a third one is forthcoming, correct?
I've heard stuff like that, but he has so many unmade projects that you know, he'll talk about something and then he'll push the ball forward for a while, and you know, it's tough to get a movie made, especially movies as unique and esoteric as his are. But hopefully he's got a new one coming out this year, Nightmare Alley, a remake of a really, really good movie from like 1949. Highly recommend checking out the original in advance of seeing that one if you haven't already. And yeah, I think after the Oscar for Shape of Water, it seems like he has a little bit more freedom. Hopefully he can get a few more things off the ground.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Well, let's jump into the mailbag here. If you out there want to contribute, ask us any questions, send us any film recommendations, you can do so by either leaving us a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. Or you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We've got a voicemail. Let's roll it.
Hey, guys. This is Ernie. I'm out in Highlands, California. And I was just wondering, do you think that the film Snowpiercer would have ended better if Chris Evans had taken the mantle and run the train instead of destroying it? Because everybody's going to die now. Everybody's dead, and he just got two survivors walking in the snow. And as far as we know, there's no one else left on Earth. So just wondering what you guys think. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so at the end of Snowpiercer, we talked a little bit about this last week. At the end of Snowpiercer, they blow up the train. You get a couple survivors, at least the only ones that we see at that point. You see this living polar bear off in the distance, and the question is there a little bit of hope? Because it's actually warming outside, so, you know, nature will find a way sort of thing. So maybe there's a hope for humanity, and now this sort of oppressive train system has been derailed. But what do you think? Do they die? Like, there's no food. It's a snow-covered fucking mountain that they're on. Like, they don't have any food. I mean, maybe they got food back in the train.
There's food now for the polar bear. I mean, those guys are mean motherfuckers. I think that may be kind of the final joke of the movie, that Bong Joon-ho knows how vicious polar bears are, and it may end on kind of an aesthetically hopeful note, but...
So it's the end of humanity? Right after... So just fucking... Humanity should just kill itself? Is that what you're saying?
If you around for the Avengers teaser at the end of the Snowpiercer credits, it's just a fucking polar bear wandering around with a bloody snout.
Yeah. But what do we think? Could Chris Evans' character have taken the mantle... taken over the train and then somehow ushered in more equality? I mean, this is like one of the great debates that you have between like a revolutionary type of takeover versus reformism or non-reformist reformism. You know, does it maintain the apparatus? Is it as impossible to actually achieve the reforming ends that you may desire to see? I don't know. What do we think? Would that have been a viable option?
Michael, what do you think, man? You didn't get to talk about Snowpiercer with us yet.
I haven't watched it since I saw it in a movie theater, I have very limited thoughts on it.
Sure.
I think they're all dead, but yeah.
But I think the question in general is one that I'm sure someone such as yourself, concerned with philosophy, has often considered, the notion of, like, you know, is it worth it to upend a sort of inherently inequitable system, even though it means not just massive collateral damage, but within this specific example, you know, quite potentially the extinction of humanity? Maybe what Austin, you had mentioned before, can the master's tools be used in some way to deconstruct the master's house, and would Chris Evans be able to have guided that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, like, nature is fine. If the option is like a shitty, unjust world, or you just blow it all to bits and let the animals cook, why not? There's the ecosystems have predated human beings. They will be around after us. I'm not precious about the continuation of humanity if it's in an oppressive form.
That's another thing that the call kind of presupposes, that human life is inherently more valuable than that of other species, or the well-being of the planet itself.
Would you rather have shit for breakfast or just not have breakfast, you know?
So that's another good question. I think we're going to be here all night, fellas.
My parents would always say that, and they meant it.
All right. Let's do one more. This is an email, real quick, from Matt, who wants to talk about Apocalypse Now. Hey, Show Me the Meaning crew, I had a question about Apocalypse Now. Leaping off Raymond's comment about Alien also debuting in 1979, do you think there might be a worthwhile comparison between Kurtz and the Xenomorph? In his I've Seen Horrors monologue, Kurtz ends on the need for using primordial instincts to kill without feeling passion or judgment, because it's judgment that defeats us. This notion echoes Ash's admiration of the alien as a survivor unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of mortality. Further, the thing Kurtz has become shifts constantly between lucid moral philosophy and brutal psychopathy. Beyond referencing the Xenomorph's shifting form, Ash might described this oscillation with its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility. Was there some latent thought influencing these two figures, or is it just a happy accident? What do you think, Raymond?
That's very insightful. I think that's a great email. I think there is there may be some universal characteristics between two sort of not necessarily evil archetypes, but in the same way that we've discussed the notion of monstrosity in Pan's Labyrinth, that you know, I don't think the xenomorph and alien is like rubbing its hands together and like, yeah, I'm out here to kill these guys or whatever. It's working off of instinct, and I think you could maybe make the same argument that at a certain point Kurtz is working off of some diabolical instinct as well. And if the I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the listener who wrote this in, Austin. Oh, Matt, and if you're interested in seeing a much more didactic interpretation of Apocalypse Now in space, I would recommend James Gray's Ad Astra. It is quite literally, like, basically a fresh adaptation of Heart of Darkness, but it takes place across the solar system. It's really, really good.
I think that movie's still underrated.
Yeah, it kind of came
in. I remember
kind of
I was freaked out when I saw it and, like, talked to friends about it. I was like, that was so good. And they're like, are you sure? I was like, I'm pretty sure.
That would give us a lot to chew on for an episode, maybe.
Well, sweet. Well, let's sign off there. Let's get out of here. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. Of course, we want more of your comments and your thoughts and your critiques and your recommendations. Call us 1-213-534-8807 or email us movies@wisecrack.co. Before we get out of here, where can people find you on the internet, Michael?
I mostly live at Wisecrack, and when I log out of work, you can find me on Twitter, @MichaelO'Burns.
Yeah, and Raymond.
Yeah, you can find me right here on Show Me the Meaning, and also on the Wisecrack Patreon, patreon.com/wisecrack. We just did our first Patreon episode there, extending the conversation about Apocalypse Now. And you can also find me on Twitter and Letterboxd, as always. I'm @Crematoria there, and Michael, thank you so much for joining us today, man.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad that I watched this movie. It's expanded my consciousness, and I want to be open to new types of art. So thank you
so much. I just
wanted
to be the first to thank you. I'm sure Austin will slide in with another thank you soon.
No, he won't.
Michael, thank you for joining us so much. We loved having you on. We love you, everybody. Find us on Twitter, SMTM_POD. Send us out, Raymond, will ya?
Oh, sure. Live from, I guess, the labyrinth underground. Just trying to work my way through this. It's Show Me the Meaning, folks. Have a great night.